Hello. In episode 102 of AS for Architecture, Nimi Atanayake and Tim O'Callaghan, founders and principals of NimTim Architects, speak about their practice, praxis and ways of working, and the ethics of being architects, particularly in light of the Grenfell Inquiry and Tim's article on that, Architecture After Grenfell.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to NimTim Architects, Nimi and Tim. Would you be so kind as to introduce yourselves?
I'm Nimi, Nimi Atanayake, one half of NimTim Architects.
And I'm Tim O'Callaghan, the other half of the founding partners of NimTim Architects.
Excellent. And when did you found, and what is NimTim Architects?
So you will probably find this throughout the podcast, but there's slight discrepancies between Tim and I. So we have a different outlook or a different idea of what happened. So I think the practice started in 2013. Tim thinks it started in 2014.
I thought it was the other way around. I thought you thought it started.
No. But as we didn't get our act together last year, we're sort of going with it's our 10-year anniversary this year. So we've been going for 10 years.
It is a bit of a grey area anyway, because I think we did start in 2013, but the company itself was incorporated in 2014. So we've got our 10-year and official 10-year anniversary as a company in March this year.
So did you form it straight out of college? Because you're extremely young looking to me. I'm not asking what your age is.
I think it might be the Zoom filter. No, we would have been, I don't know.
It was about 5 years post part three that we started it.
Yeah.
So we were both working for a multitude of different practices. Tim's practices, I guess, tended to be quite design led, you know, quite reputable people such as Chipperfield and OMA and then RCKA. And I worked for more smaller practices, as well as a bit of a mix. I did also Hawkins Brown and Pannoy and Prasad. And then I was made redundant from Hawkins Brown, and we took a gap year and sort of, well, took a year off and went traveling. It was around 2008, 2009, so the economy was doing really badly. There was a lot of government funded work. A lot of the government funded work had implications after the kind of Iceland banks crashed. So we decided to take a year out. And then we came back, and after that, we started working at smaller practices. Tim mostly did residential projects. I did more residential, but for developers, so people like Grosvenor Estates and Cadogan Estates, who run a lot of like elite properties in central London. And then I was diagnosed with cancer, ovarian cancer. And I guess it made us take stock a little bit of our work-life balance and our kind of design creativity and what we wanted out of practice. And then Tim left RCKA to initially start NimTim on his own. I think we had a few jobs that we did while we were in practice. And then once we had enough on our books, or maybe just it just came at the right time, Tim decided to leave practice and set up from the dining room table.
In East London?
No, South.
South East London.
Ah, wow.
South, I know, we're in a little bit of a bubble. There's not many. Well, there are now, but at the time there weren't that many small practices.
Hmm.
It was very candid, Nimi, and I'm kind of a little humbled, but that must have been quite a thing. So the survival of cancer, I mean, kind of leaves one a little bit wordless.
We I think it's an important thing to own in a way. And although it does make me slightly uncomfortable, I think that it is such a massive part of why we do what we do. And mm-hmm. To kind of gloss over it would just wouldn't make sense. Mm. So I think we do acknowledge that was a very large reason as to why we started NimTim. And unfortunately, I was quite young. Well, that's what the doctors tell me. I was very young for being diagnosed. So it was there was a lot of kind of life questions going on and reassessing, and like I mentioned, the work-life balance. And so I think NimTim was born out of that, really.
Yeah, I think, even more so for Nimi, obviously, but even as a partner of someone going through that at that age, and we were just in our early 30s, it's quite a sort of profoundly changing, life-changing experience. And I think it just sort of spurs you to sort of to try the things that you've been talking about doing or thinking about doing. And one of those was kind of, maybe doing our own thing. And I think we kind of didn't really go into it with huge expectations about what it would be. It was kind of, it was, we didn't kind of enter with a manifesto or grand ambitions about what we wanted to do specifically. I think it was more just about having the chance to create.
Design,
Well,
yeah,
I
being
think like, well,
creative.
I think like lead, have a bit more agency within the projects that we're working on. And also to, it's a really naff way of saying it, but like curate our life a bit. and obviously now that I think you asked a bit earlier, like what is NimTim? Well, it's a practice of 10 people now. Now that is a slightly different, it's a slightly different ball game because that in itself requires quite a kind of commitment of time. And obviously, in order to kind of lead a team of that size, and it's not huge, but a team like that, you have to show and demonstrate your own kind of commitment and time commitment if you're asking your team to do the same thing. So there's kind of gone round in a circle a little bit, but at the time, I think we just needed the space as well, just to kind of like emerge from that experience and.
And also reconnect with architecture. It was really nice actually, because a lot of our early projects, we could just have, we could have fun, we could be creative, we could be playful. Obviously, we still had to kind of work within the remits of building regulations and budgets and things like that. But I think we just enjoyed having, like Tim said, the agency to and an outlet for our creative kind of designs that we'd been, fostering and nurturing along our kind of education and then our work experience.
I was going to say, if you thought your work-life balance was out of whack when you were in practice, you're now a reasonably large business. I mean, that doesn't sound like you've done a very good job of sorting your work-life balance. I mean, managing 10 people must be pretty hard work.
No, but there's been, I mean, for me anyway, there's been a really big fundamental shift where I think a few years ago I learned that actually, because now we make what we do, we can make the practice, and we can sort of take on, we get to decide, we have ownership about which jobs we do and which jobs we don't, or what we get involved in amongst the built environment. It means that it's very, well, it's very chaotic, it's very diverse in terms of what architecture is to us. And that has its benefit in that we love what we do. The disadvantage is that you're kind of, it becomes your life in a way. And the distinction between home and work is very much blurred. You never know when you might go to the playground and take your child and you'll run into a client, and there's been loads of instances where we've gone to the theatre and there's a client, or we've gone for a meal, like a date night, and there's a client, and so it means actually we are always NimTim architects to a certain degree. But because we love that and we have good relationships with the people that we work with, it's not a burden. And it's a very, it's, I mean, we're very, very privileged to enjoy what we do.
How does running a medium-sized practice, I was talking about this with someone yesterday, the way that practice seems to be either going massive, super large, huge practices that do huge amounts of huge work, or the smaller business, which is agile and kind of flexible. You're a medium-sized practice, really. I mean, on the scale of things, on the kind of metric of things, how is that working out? Obviously, that places demands on achieving certain scales of projects, and yeah, just the turnover must be massive on something like that, which is becomes quite tricky, doesn't it?
It is about efficiencies of scale. Like I think the bigger you are, the more efficient you have to become. But I think we very much see ourselves as being I mean, maybe this is naive, but we still see ourselves being an emerging practice, still very agile and nimble, and try and use those words to our benefit. But, you know, we spoke to MoCo the other day, and they also, you know, MoCo, quite a large practice, quite a reputable practice that's been going for a number of years. They also see themselves as a small practice and say that they function very much like that because they don't want to lose the essence of what they were when they were a small practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing in a broader sense. I think you're going to see, I think it's going to get harder for medium-sized practices, I think, for lots of different reasons. I think you might see a kind of hardening of what you're describing, that there's like small and very big, and it's very hard to make anything work in between. I think we are small. I think one thing that we've been 10 for like, 4 years, four or 5 years. We kind of grew to that size in lockdown and COVID time, and weren't quite ready for that as a sort of in terms of management, in terms of systems. So we worked quite hard to make it work. I mean, we have quite a balance of work of smallish scale private residential projects and larger collaborative or larger public realm work that we're doing ourselves as kind of lead architect. And so far the balance has been quite helpful in a way that we've worked really hard to make the small scale resi work for this financially. That means having good systems in place, having a really good team that we can trust in place, and also a process that doesn't require our input for it to work.
But yet still retain a lot of the elements that we've always thought important for those small projects.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we still have kind of an oversight of everything, but we're not relying on our input to design it. You know, we have a process that involves, you know, that anyone in our team can follow. We have a structure that means that each project is kind of appropriately resourced with the right level of experience for what we're trying to do and what the client requires. And then actually having that stream of small scale residential work, which we've developed quite a good in terms of inquiries, in terms of getting, you know, projects come to us, we're through kind of our work with in terms of PR and social media, that's quite reliable. And it allows us to not have this accordion effect of kind of growing and contracting, which a lot of small and medium-sized practices often suffer from. So we've been lucky not to have to do that so far. And
I think it's something that we feel quite comfortable with, that size of work. On the flip side, we are doing more larger scale pieces, architecture, built environment, that we're working as part of a team. So we're working with larger practices on sort of collaborative teams to deliver. And it's those sorts of situations where we still feel very young, actually, and very, very small, because, you know, we're working with Carrie Kusevich, Carson Architects, Henny Hale Brown, DRMM, and you know, more larger system architects. And so that is quite nice, because actually we get the sense of still learning and still challenging ourselves and still trying to take elements of what we feel is important, and that we show in our small scale resi, and how we try and deliver that on a larger scale, whether it's public realm works or kind of housing regeneration schemes.
I think it's really interesting that you've worked out, you've systematized or semi-systematized the small scale residential, because there's something very interesting about, I mean, residential is so complex, but the fact that it's so bespoke, it tends towards the bespoke, that it becomes enormously costly for the client, can do anyway, and certainly in the practices I've worked at it seemed to, so that it becomes a service that's not really available. Architecture becomes a service that's not really available to people outside fairly elite economic group. Whereas if you can systematize it, I suppose you can deliver high-end design like your own to a broader public.
I think that was something that we...
Which just makes sense good, like, business-wise, like, obviously, doesn't it?
The more people you can reach, the more business you make, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, that was something we felt really early on that we wanted to be really inclusive and bring people into the process. And so a lot of the domestic clients, they have no idea about the building procurement, you know, that the work, RIBA work stages, for example, or building regulations. And it was enabling a simple language that they could understand and then get on board on with, you know, become empowered by. And we've had, you know, because it is a lot of money, but it's also, it's a lot of money regardless of, it's sort of relative to your income. So, you know, 100 grand might be a lot of money, 500 grand might be a lot of money, depending on each family. And it was always a really, really personal journey that you would take, because it's a lot more time and a lot more kind of care and individuality that goes with those small scale projects that you that become a bit more standardized in the bigger scale.
I think it's an interesting, like, that's an interesting thing that we've always thought about, that we've always wanted to try and be able to kind of deliver something that anyone and everyone can benefit from the input of an architect. Because I think there's something about scale that's always been a challenge for the industry, and a perception that you kind of only, you have to work at a certain scale for it to ever work. But I think what we tried to do is sort of think about, and it kind of came, I guess it came from the beginnings of the practice where we were doing like ridiculously small scale projects, you know, and kind of some of the earliest work we had was like for people who were kind of looking to buy something, and we do like quick sketches of like how they might change the layout or do an extension or subdivide a house to kind of sell it as flats or something like that. And you're kind of seeing then the kind of thing that an architect does at its kind of basic, most basic form, and kind of, and actually it's, and you can see its value in its most basic form, that you're delivering quite an kind of something really quite useful for people who really quite value that input. So what we've always tried to sort of see if we can do that. So one thing we've done, for instance, is we haven't done it for a while, and we need to kind of do it. We've talked about doing it again, is kind of drop in sort of design surgeries in the office, where people, householders or business, small business owners, can come in, and we'll just kind of give them, you know, an hour of ideas and sketching and, you know, time to explore what they might do with the space that they have. And when we first started, we did this sort of thing where we'd do like a day with people, and it would sort of be, we'd do a kind of quick hand sketch. We'd like survey it in an hour, the space, draw it up to scale, and then we kind of work through some ideas, and we charge a few hundred quid for it. And it actually, you know, it's a really an interesting service. And, you know, our clients have been, you know, we've had clients who have, you know, obviously architecture is always going to be at some point a kind of quite elite or kind of expensive thing that not everyone can afford. But we have had clients with, you know, relatively ordinary or, you know, what might be considered ordinary jobs, school teachers, you know, doctors, retirees, and people who, you know, wouldn't normally expect to, might not more normally expect to kind of be able to engage with an architect service. So we've always been looking at how we might adjust our service to let everyone be able to kind of take advantage of it.
Really interesting idea, because the idea of generalizing the value of design across society is certainly something I think, maybe we get this when we talk about Grenfell in a little bit, but certainly something that's a huge value, I think. And I think our architects radically undersell it. As an industry, I think we're structured to undersell it. It's a weird kind of...
Yeah, I think we're structured. I think it's a real shame on the education and the definitions that we put on ourselves as to what an architect is and what they should be. And actually, if you break that down, I think it's always been a stigma associated with architecture. And I think actually, when you look at a lot of the graduates now that are coming out of education, they're making architecture become what they want it to be. You know, they're operating in different ways within the built environment, but still resonating with the word architect. And I think everything else needs to catch up. You know, industry and education needs to catch up, and regulatory bodies need to catch up to the definition of an architect, and how we are open and how we are approachable, and get rid of that kind of stuffy language and kind of preconceptions that we've always had. I think it's a real stigma and almost our own sort of limiting factor.
And what we found, what's kind of interesting, is that I think architects almost undervalue themselves more than clients do. And one of the interesting experiences that we've had is a lot of architects have a rule about, like, oh, we don't do projects under 100,000, or we don't do 100, under 150, because it just doesn't make sense. But I guess the question is, like, who does it not make sense to? Because we quite often have people, we sort of have a structure that's, yeah, you know, we our full service doesn't work under 150, but we quite often have clients say, come to us and say, okay, I've got 50,000, or, you know, I've got a relatively small amount, but I'm happy to pay you quite a lot, you know, what would be considered quite a large proportion, like percentage of that, because I want what I spend to be done right and done really well. So it's almost like they're telling us, like, no, I know you don't think that you think that you might be too expensive to do this, but you're not. We value the design and we're willing to pay for it, even if, like, the money that we have to spend overall isn't what you might think or what you might hope. So it's almost sometimes like clients are the ones telling us that actually, no, we value what you do more than you think. And we're happy to spend a relatively high amount of what we have in order to get make sure that it's kind of done right. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And I think, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, I think architecture needs to break out from this idea of, so we're very apologetic about our value and our cost.
Yeah, I think so. You're a London practice, obviously, a South London practice, and you've been part included in part of this ANU framework, the Mayor of London's ANU framework. I guess they don't really seem to stick together, but like, what is the ANU framework? How did you get involved in it as a London practice? What is the kind of knowledge that you bring to that?
The A plus U framework is a framework of architects and urban designers and designers for different types of work, different typologies of work,
Called lots.
different lots. So you have, like, so for instance, we're on the public realm and landscape, and separately the small sites housing lots. So we're two lots out of, I think, 10, 9.
And you bid for these.
Yeah, so it's a process where you bid for each lot, and you have to present a in this case it was like a case study.
It was the first stage was open, wasn't it? The first kind of
Yeah, there was a
it
shortlisting
so
stage.
you kind of put together a PQQ with like a written document basically. From that shortlist, they would invite you to then, is it called bid?
Bid for the an invitation to tender.
And you would have to produce two case studies, one for each lot, basically. And you had to sort of create your own project, I guess, and your own design for that project. That kind of demonstrates what you can bring to the A plus U. Yeah, so we were really lucky that we went for two, and we
We
were
went for three.
we went for
We were
three.
shortlisted for two, and then we were lucky enough to get
Both.
appointed on two of those lots. I mean, it was really important for us because I think we've been looking to kind of
Diversify.
grow the practice, kind of look at doing more public work, larger scale work, and be getting onto a framework was one of the key things that we identified as a goal.
So this is the London Mayor's framework, which all local authorities can have access to. So if any local authority has a project, they can use the people on that lot, those that were shortlisted for that lot, to tender to that lot for that project. So yeah, it's quite a prestigious thing to be on, and there was a number of amazing other practices also shortlisted. So we feel, yeah, again, very privileged.
I think it meant quite a lot for us as a practice, as a kind of to identify us as kind of having at least the potential to kind of go into that kind of that realm. And we have done projects like that through different avenues. I mean, interestingly, we haven't got any work out of it yet.
It was launched a year ago.
It was just under a year ago. Just under a year ago, I think we were informed about a year ago that we'd been shortlisted or appointed, and then it's been running, I think, about 7, 8 months or something like that.
But it's very hard to quantify because although councils haven't come through the A plus U framework, I think it's one of those things that you just become on their radar. So we have subsequently been approached by other local authorities separately and individually, but, and been invited to tender for certain bids. And I think their awareness of us in part is coming from A plus U framework. Although it's harder to quantify, and that's not, you know, there's nothing recorded. It's just our sort of feeling.
And as what do you think was seen in the in your work? Obviously, it's excellent, beautiful, and amazing. Leaving that aside, putting that over there, was it your kind of particular flavor, the particular flavor of your architecture that made you particularly stand out? And was that because you have this kind of embedded London knowledge as a practice who've spent time thinking and working in the environments that you have?
I think it was more about our process. I think it was about the processes that we developed and the processes in which we work within.
Specifically around these two lots that you got. So specifically around engagement and the way that you work with communities.
I think so. I think that was a really strong contributing factor, because I think for small sites housing and also public realm, a lot of the success of those projects depends on the community that you build, whether that's fostering the existing community or welcoming the new community into whatever the project is. I think there's a huge emphasis now on engagement and social impact of what of built environment. I think that was a large part in why we were shortlisted.
I mean, for the case studies, you could use projects that you'd actually built, or you could kind of develop your own kind of almost like competition entry style proposal. So we actually decided, although we had projects that we could potentially have put forward, we decided to use the opportunity to explore some new ideas for both lots, for the small sites and the public realm. And I think it was kind of a nice opportunity. I think your thing is with these things, you have to go into them with the idea or with the knowledge that even if you don't get it, you've learned something from it and the process has been useful. Because I mean, the procurement, we could do a whole nother 2-hour chat about procurement in architecture, but you know, the process is hard and you don't often win. We had a lot of frameworks that we'd gone for, you know, that we haven't got before this. So I think it's always good to kind of go and say, well, even if we don't get it, is this still going to be useful for us as a practice in terms of developing ideas, in terms of refining what we're about or kind of putting things out there or creating your own opportunities? And I think that was in both cases that we kind of aimed to do that. An interesting thing is the landscape lot, which we looked at a new kind of active travel route, like public walking and cycling in Erith in Bexley. We used what we produced to approach the council and presented our ideas to them, which led to another opportunity in the borough. So I think you have to look at it as things that you will learn from anyway. And I think in both cases, we put together something that we're quite proud of. And I think there is the narrative about kind of engaging and participatory design. I think one thing that we became more confident about talking about as something that we're good at is I think we're good at telling stories, understanding a place, at really kind of analysing it and understanding objectives and briefs, and then creating a narrative that people can kind of understand and relate to. So I think that's something that it's emerged as something that we're more confident is a strength of ours. And I think it's certainly in the projects that I think we prepared for that bid was a strength. They had got a very strong and clear narrative.
On your practice website, you have this little bit about what you're thinking about, and there's essay on architecture after Grenfell, which is good. It's a bold thing to put on a website, because it's a shameful thing, Grenfell, I suppose, and I don't think many people in the profession have been so keen to look at it quite as closely as you do. And you say in there that you talk about the moral imperative that it imposes on architecture. You say it deserves to be a watershed in the entire culture of the industry. I was wondering if you could talk about that. I mean, I've been kind of obsessed about it ever since, as a kind of indicative of it should be, for me, it should be an endpoint in a culture of architecture which could produce something as miserable as that. Do you think it has? What do you think, generally speaking, about what it implies? And what do you think about the future of practice in relation to it?
Tim wrote that piece and has subsequently been asked to sort of write further pieces and on that subject. So I'm going to refer to you.
So I wrote that in the middle of the inquiry in a sort of moment of outrage, I guess, or kind of like shock and horror at some of the stuff that was emerging. And it's now, I guess it's quite a different context in the sense that the Building Safety Act has completely changed everything. Mm-hmm. And in a way responded to a lot of the things I was saying in that essay. I mean, I think the thing, it's interesting to sort of talk about it in the context of architecture. Clearly architects play a role and played a role mm-hmm. in what happened. I think one takeaway is that from it was that, you know, you could see they were just pawns in a kind of much bigger context and game that really sat behind what happened there, political, in terms of like business practices, regulatory systems, all of those things I think were more shocking to me than, in fact, what happened with the architects sort of felt quite familiar to a lot of architects, where it's kind of, you know, they'd come in with one idea that had been kind of, you know, completely changed and kind of value engineered. And it seemed like they were fairly powerless within that process to push back. Clearly there was mistakes made, and they, you know, clearly they were not competent or experienced enough to take on a role like that. And the Building Safety Act changes that. So there's some very fundamental changes that are have already come into play, which I think the architects are really a bit behind, including ourselves, that do change that. And I think that is the watershed. The question for the profession is, what do we do with that? Mm-hmm. Do we use it as an opportunity to wrest back power and control and better pay and better fees? They're the opportunity. I think the opportunity is there. Mm-hmm. So
you think that the way that, again, go back to this idea of the structuring of practice, the structuring of architectural production, our role, the architect's role within situations like Grenfell, I mean, Grenfell was the unlucky one, transpires as loads of buildings with that inflammable stuff on the outside of it. Is this because the architect, in your view, is this because the architect has become a pawn and has relinquished too much of their kind of professional authority, a professional and moral authority? Have we relinquished it? Have we had it taken? And is there any way of getting any of it back?
I think
back?
It's a tricky one, because I think a lot of things now have to, so there's certain materials that you have to use that have been tested and accredited for that system. And often there are some that might be more natural or might be better placed, but because they haven't been tested to our standards, you could never propose on something of that size or scale. And it's very tricky, because you sort of need the regulations to kind of, for example, the Building Safety Act to give you a better outcome. But at the same time, you need some wiggle room within it so that you can use your own judgment about what you know, which might be related to your values and ethics, and what is the right thing to do for that project. So for example, I think in that piece, we, you know, and as a practice, we had a chat about it, and we thought one of the ways in which we could act was to stop specifying kind of PIR flammable insulation as the first instance. You know, if a client specifically wants to use that and we've pointed them to the article and to our ethics and values, and they still go ahead and use a PIR, that's their remit. but we, on, for example, Cork House project, we used Cork, which has a lot of great properties and makes it an ideal thing to use as an insulative product and a cladding system, acoustic, etc. But it isn't tested to the same accreditation as some other products, who have the money and who lobby to get certificates. So it's really difficult. You know, you are limited in terms of how, you know, the breadth of which you can specify.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you decide in your domestic work to not use PIR and instead use sheep's wool, you basically turn your house into a massive mice
factory. With thick walls. Yeah. You know, because again, like, to use sheep's wool, you need a greater amount than the sort of high performing PIR. So it's, yeah, it is a real.
And you know, when you're charging whatever the price per square meter of developable land in a major city, actually the difference between a 300 and a 450 thickness wall is a lot of money.
That's where, you know, that's why I think we felt justified in writing the piece that then supports the argument that we can't just be going, you know, you can't be doing just the easiest thing or the cheapest thing. You know, you've got to think about the greater good. And I think as architects, we have a responsibility to put that forwards and to try and push that. Whether or not the clients take us up on that is one thing. But I think we've got a responsibility. Well, we felt to ourselves that we had a responsibility to do that.
I mean, actually, it was actually more in it was also, it was about the material, but it was also in that instance about the behavior of the companies, specifically the insulation companies, that we wanted to sort of say, and which we've stuck by, we're not going to specify products by these companies because of the way they behaved.
Are you talking about name brand?
Yeah. PIR, I think one of them has changed the brand now, but
I mean, don't you name them on your piece?
Yeah, I do. It's Celotex and Kingspan. Yeah. And we felt that the behavior of both within the project, that was sort of in the way that they behaved during in the process, that was evidenced in the inquiry and after and during the inquiry itself, was unacceptable. And in our capacity as domestic architects, we have some power, a limited amount of power, one of which is that we can, you know, actually, you know, clients really listen to you on domestic projects much more than they do on commercial projects, I would say. And we can advocate for not using those products and specifically anything from those companies. Now, you know, the corporate world is kind of big and complex and people move around it, and you know, whether they are unique in the way that they behave, but we did feel, I think we did feel very strongly quite outraged by it at the time, and that was a very small thing that we could do.
I was reading an article yesterday about vinyl. I had no idea that vinyl was only in the 70s. Vinyl manufacturers were forced to admit that it emitted carcinogenic fumes. I was like, oh, didn't know that. So it happens over and over again in practice. I just thought it was very interesting. I could see the correlation between this kind of, it's a strongly worded piece that you write and a passionate piece. But I did like this idea of, and one of the reasons that I was very keen on talking to you as a practice was this idea of the return of an ethicality to architecture, which I think is really interesting. It's something that you were saying at the beginning, Nimia, about young practitioners coming out, students coming out of out of education and starting to turn, not accepting the kind of business as usual, not accepting the kind of structure, the hierarchical structure of practice. And do you feel like, in a way, that is part of your goal as an architectural practice, is to kind of not just deploy design in a more generalized sense, but also to kind of retune the enterprise of practice around that professional ethical imperative?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it's massively important to us, the culture of the office and the culture of the studio. I think I specifically have never really felt at home within the profession. I've never seen myself reflected up until, you know, fairly recently. I've never been in a working environment that I've really felt comfortable in, or that my views and difference is going to be accepted. And I think because of all those things that I had experienced, I feel really passionate about not replicating that. And I'm very clear on what I don't want the practice to become. And I think we have been quite successful in being quite transparent and being quite open and kind of allowing autonomy for the people that come into the practice. It's not just a kind of, it's not, you know, although our names are on the sign, it's not really us dictating what happens. It is a collective, and we feel very strongly about that. And I think when we've brought people in to the practice, you know, brought their views in and what they're passionate about, I think we've gotten better. So I think, yeah, it's something that we're keen to continue and learn from. I think we understand that, you know, we've got to continue to learn. Otherwise, we'll become, you know, prehistoric or something. You know, I just think we'll become irrelevant. And I think the ways that we can learn are from the graduates.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, that we've done a few things like podcasts and lectures where people were kind of asking us what the practice is about and what we're doing and what we believe in. I mean, one thing that we've kind of learned is that we've had, I mean, not had to, but we've decided that we've made a conscious decision that it's not going to be just about us. You know, NIMTIM is a kind of, it's not exactly our names. And one thing, you know, it's not exactly our names. It's sort of a play on our names, but it's the whole point is that it's not just about us. And we want and encourage everyone within the team to contribute towards what we're about and the kind of ethos of the practice. Mm-hmm. So, and then for a lot of the things, so I mean, I wrote something recently about pay in architecture, which was in the AJ, the Architects Journal. And that was something I'd spent a lot of time with asking the team to kind of comment on, because it really came about as a kind of thinking about what graduate pay is in architecture compared to other professions or other jobs and how bad it is. And I just thought, you know, and I think their view was really, really important. So I think it's the same whenever we, even when we're thinking about, okay, what's the message? What's our kind of ethos as a practice? What's our mission? What's our kind of, you know, how do we define ourselves? That's something that's not just, it starts off with a conversation between myself and Nimi, but it's also something that we involve the whole team in. Because we also want them to feel like they have some kind of influence within the practice, and that it's a kind of a project in itself that they all belong to.
Yeah, I think that's what I was getting when Nimi was talking. I was kind of, I thought that I asked a question about the shape of practice and the way that the architect operates in the world, and you answered about the shape of your practice. And I think that's quite an interesting idea. And I've read it in other texts that how you formulate your practice as a designer sort of sets the foundation for how you can go out into the world to deliver your service, which is a rather beautiful idea, really. It's a sort of process orientation rather than an object orientation.
I think, yeah, and it makes you stronger because of that. If you know, it's not just your vision, if you like, because one person's vision might be very different to someone else's, and all you can really do is base it on your own experiences and understand that that is something that should be included along with other people's, you know. I think, yeah, I think that's something that we've always kind of rallied against, that kind of ego architecture.
Yeah, I don't think it's really important. Like, I think, and also who you connect with in terms of like clients and people that you're going to work with. I think it's all part of the same thing. And one thing, you know, you don't learn a lot about practice and the importance of practice structures and kind of financial approaches and things like that within when you're studying architecture. Actually, it's kind of really important. And I think that, you know, a good practice is only a small amount about what the designs that you produce. It's kind of, I think it encompasses everything. Like how do you manage the practice financially? How do you look after your staff? How do you kind of deal with the recruitment processes? How do you, all these kind of boring, what we are quite often perceived as boring kind of business running things. So actually I think really important and a really kind of sit hand in hand with like how you design and the kind of the architecture that you're creating.
I just wanted to finish really on just sort of pretty basic question. If you could go back to studying again, I don't know where you studied, but what would you want to know now? Now you know what you know. What would you want to have been taught, or was the very, I'm assuming if you're pretty much the same vintage as me, possibly a little younger, assuming very design orientated and largely impractical education in thinking about Peter Zumthor's baths at Vowels, mainly.
Sounds very...
I mean, that was all I can kind of recall from my undergraduate studies. What would you prefer to know? What would be useful? I mean, this thing that you've said about how to run a practice and quote unquote, the boring things of architecture, which are actually the things that make design architecture. You know what I mean? What else is there?
So I studied at Nottingham for my undergrad, and then we both met at Westminster doing our postgrad masters. We started off in the same unit under Jean Sillett, but then I went to be in a unit under Fat, Sean Griffiths and Kester, and Tim carried on at Jean's, and he studied his undergrad at Oxford Brookes. I guess for me, I think it's probably very different for both of us. I guess for me, it would be this idea of the facets of architecture. It was all about building a building. It was, here's good details, here's kind of to do the vernacular architecture, here's good examples, here is Peter Zumthor. You know, I feel like, you know, knowing that a workshop, you know, running a workshop for a primary school about built environment is part of the profession. I feel like sort of doing, I don't know, writing about architecture is architecture, you know, doing lectures is architecture, doing a podcast is architecture, doing a photo shoot, you know, doing an art installation, all these different facets can still constitute the profession. And I just felt like it was very one idea of what architecture is, as well as all the practical things like how do you run a business, how do you do a tax return, that sort of stuff. I just think it would have been great to know about different ways in which you can practice. And I think it's really refreshing that a lot of the graduates now are coming out and they're starting movements. You know, I think it's so exciting that they have the confidence to start a movement within architecture and still resonate with the profession. I think that's great.
Yeah, I don't regret too much. I don't know. I don't regret anything. I loved it. I loved the education that I got. Clearly, I think it should be different now anyway.
Well, there was barely any internet when I was doing undergraduate.
I think I got...
We used to have to go into the John Rylands Library in Manchester and line up to do email.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I mean, all of my undergrad until third year was done in hand drawing. Nothing was... done on CAD. I mean, it's such a changing world, isn't it? It's quite interesting. And I guess maybe that was something that's good about the architecture education, that you do accept that things are changing and you learn to be very malleable. But you can only be as malleable as you see in front of you, if you know what I mean. And I wish I'd been shown more ways of being malleable.
I think there could be with a little bit, I think architecture could do with a little bit more interconnection between academia and practice. I think there's too few practitioners in education. I think particularly sort of successful commercial practitioners. And I think, you know, the kind of judgment of what constitutes kind of design architecture and kind of, you know, what constitutes good architecture is kind of interesting and maybe could do with being challenged. I don't know. I haven't been in education for a few years. I did a bit of teaching. But I think certainly, I think one thing the profession in general could really do with is kind of looking at our value and looking at like, and specifically our financial value. And what can we offer? Where can we go? What spaces can we kind of move into? Where can this kind of very special, this kind of very unique set of kind of ways of thinking about the world that we have be kind of in a very blunt way monetized? And where can we kind of get the agency back into the profession? I think maybe kind of bridging that gap a bit more. Certainly you see it, I think I did an Erasmus exchange in Germany. There's a lot more kind of connection between the kind of practice, the world of practicing architecture and academia there, that I, at least in terms of what I saw. And I think that would be healthy.
But with things like LSA and stuff like that, it is changing the way that you, yeah, you're getting your education now is changing, and that relationship to practice is becoming stronger.
Definitely. But yeah, but like I said, I don't regret it, or I wouldn't go back and change it.
Oh, I think I would. I really struggled. I just didn't see my place in it again. And I think also I find that sometimes your lived in experiences or the things that that make you different aren't celebrated enough within architecture. It's sort of, they have an aesthetic that you adhere to, you know, Helvetica font and Peter Zumthor type minimalism. And actually that kind of exuberance, it was only until I really got into FATS unit that, you know, I sort of resonated with something that was joyous and playful and colourful and fun. And I could actually bring a part of me to what I was designing. And that was in my final year of Masters.
I think that's a wonderful point to finish on. Thank you so very much, Nim and Tim Architects. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Ambrose.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
As the great Lauren Hill said, now don't you understand, man, universal law? What you throw out comes back to you, star. Never a truer word spoken in rap. Thank you to Nimi and Tim for taking the time to speak with me on the podcast. It was much appreciated. And thanks also for their beautiful and inspiring body of work. Please see the podcast description for links to them, as ever. And thanks for listening.